Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jerry Mander. Jerry Mander is the author of many books, including the books Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television and In the Absence of the Sacred, considered by many environmental activists to be two of the most important books of the late 20th century. And I know that sounds like hyperbole, but I have to say in the weeks up to this interview, I've told so many people I'm going to interview you again, and the first thing out of their mouths when I say that is, oh, his books changed my life. So whatever.
That's good to hear.
Whatever else we get out of this interview, I want you to know how absolutely crucial your work has been to just so many people who are doing good work in the world.
Well, thank you so much for that. Thank you.
So first off, thank you for that great work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
So I first interviewed you back in 1990-something. And One of the things that you said during that interview that has always stuck with me was something to the effect of, and I think of this probably once a week, no matter how much activists may use computers to organize their movements, we must never forget that computers are being used far more effectively by corporations and the military.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you could just sort of reflect on that a little bit.
Well, I mean, the computers are the primary instrument by which the powers that be maintain power and communicate with each other and communicate with us. And there's more of them and they got more money and they do it all the time. And we're on the receiving end most of the time. We're not on the sending end most of the time. And so it's been more useful for them than for us. We're trying to use it as much as we can, but not so easy. We don't have as much money as they do.
And I think one of the important implications of that comment, too, is that we should not judge a technology primarily by how we are personally able to use it. We need to look at the larger social effects of that piece of technology, which is one of the many wonderful things I think that you really have brought to the discussion.
Absolutely, I agree with that. I mean, we may have fun using the technology. We may be able to get our message across to each other and to a certain audience, but we don't have the kind of money that requires blasting through and controlling the whole media and controlling consciousness in general. And they do. So technology, as usual, is serving the inventors of it or the owners of it better than it serves us. That's all. It doesn't mean we can't make use of it and try our best, but that's what we're doing right now.
Right, exactly. So let's step back. And I know this is a long time ago, but can you quickly summarize your, I loved and found so important your book Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. Can you talk a little bit about why television should be eliminated, and then also bring that more up to date with the internet as well?
Well, television is, you know, no technology in itself can be looked at and said this is a bad thing. You have to always look at it in terms of its relationship to the larger world and relationship to general consciousness and so on. And television is intrinsically, you know, if you and I had a television and could talk to each other through it and so on, that wouldn't be really a bad thing. But the problem is that the nature of technology these days is that it's dominated by the people who have the most money to dominate it. And that technology, just like any other technology, dominates consciousness and dominates business and dominates communications and it overwhelms us. It may be good in itself, you know. It'd be hard to argue that some of these technologies are bad. It's just a question of who controls them and how they're used and whether they're used equally, whether all sources in the population have access to them to the same degree. And so the real question is how they're changing, how they're influencing domination or centralization of communications and making our lives and our attempts to do it more difficult. You know, it's really simple. Does that sound simple?
Yeah, it does. And it's
I mean, if you have control of a technology, and the technology is broad and powerful, and you can use it more than I can use it, then you're going to dominate the thing, period. It's so much, the technology itself is sort of not the problem in a way, but it's the fact that its entry into the global communications world and among global populations, the net effect is to gain power and gain control and create its own consciousness. We have to find a way to keep up with that, or to prevent it, or to present our arguments in as powerful a way, but we don't have the money that they have, so it's very difficult.
Yeah, so you or I could put up our blog, and there will be 75 people read it. And,
absolutely.
And that's great.
And they'll be impressed, and they'll send it to their friends, but there won't be like a million people read it, which is what would happen if it was done, you know, via the networks that exist.
So let's go a different direction. You have been associated with deep ecology for a long time. Can you tell us? I don't think I've ever actually done an interview where someone has defined deep ecology, made the distinction between deep and shallow ecology. Can you do that, and then just discuss a little bit?
Well, you may not have ever been involved in that. I don't think I've been involved in defining deep ecology either, actually, to tell you the truth. I guess deep ecology, I mean, I don't know how to answer that question, because deep ecology is just the effort to take ecological information to its fundamentals and to its absolute ability to communicate and try to use it to one's benefit, or to, you know, then everybody's competing for it. So deep ecology is it just a much more deep and broad effort to use ecological management, I suppose. I don't know. That's not a very good definition, but I don't know how to answer that question.
Well, here's my perspective on it, which is that deep ecology would be, when I've seen definitions of shallow ecology, that would be the idea that by merely making a few tweaks around the edges, we can make this culture more or less sustainable. And deep ecology would suggest that there are more profound and fundamental changes are required in order to achieve sustainability.
Yes, I think you put that well. And, you know, it's really a question of money, because if you and I, who probably share mostly similar ecological values, I'm guessing, we don't know each other very well, but I have a feeling that you're from a similar worldview as me. We can think about ecology very deeply and so on, but we don't have necessarily control of the systems that cause the change in the world and that cause domination in the world. And that's a question of who's got the money to control it and the ability and the physical power to do that. Do I answer that question? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think so. And it also seems to me that, as well as money, that excuse me, a lot of the technologies are would be, it's not okay, if you would like to eat an apple, You can.
I would like to what? What did
if you,
you
would like
eat
to
eat an apple?
If you would like to eat an apple, and yeah. you want to eat an apple in 20 years, you can plant an apple tree in your backyard, and then you'll have an apple in a while. But if you want to make a computer or make a computer network, or make a global transportation network, that one can't do that in their own backyard. So it seems to me that, yes, it's the money that controls them, but at the same time, the infrastructures necessary to create these technologies are also, they require these large, they require a billionaire to do it.
Yeah, but the billionaires have created that infrastructure. I mean, it's I don't know what you want to say about what comes first, but the situation is that the billionaires have created controls, and now they're able to control everything. And everything, most things depend upon having the money to really use them well and to use them broadly, and or else you can't really compete. So it's the billionaires are the people who dominate it because the society is based on money. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure I understand your question.
Yeah, it does. My question was just that that the technologies themselves, so I could assemble a bow and arrow in my backyard. I could go cut off a limb and I could find some string and I could make one, but I could not build a car in my backyard. That would require the entire system. That's the only point I'm making, is that it's, yes.
Yeah, if you have money, you can do it. If you don't have money, you can't do it.
Yeah, exactly. So let's go a slightly different direction. And I want to go all the way back to David Brower and to talk about your work with him and how you started a nonprofit advertising organization that seems to be an attempt to counter some of the incessant propaganda that it comes from those with a lot of money.
Yeah. I mean, it's obvious. Dave Brower and I had a lot to say. We had a lot of issues we wanted to battle with, you know. I was very inspired by him and his work. He came to me because he knew that I was somebody who can use media well and effectively, and that I knew how to do that, and I knew how to take his viewpoint and turn that into campaign language and use campaign instruments like advertising. So just then it depended whether we could raise the money for the advertising. And between us, we managed to raise some money, and we were able to do ads that were very, very powerful, and were more powerful per ad than the opposite side, and were very effective because our point of view on some of these same issues was not being expressed very well or loudly. If we wanted to block, you know, we wanted to prevent some terrible outcome, we knew how to oppose the problem, but we didn't necessarily have the money to achieve it, and so we had to go raise the money, and then we had to do stuff that the public can respond to enough so that they'll give us more money to do more of it. I mean, that's sort of obvious. You get to express your viewpoint if you have the money to do it, and so we spent a lot of time doing that, raising the money to do it. But Dave Brower and others had the ideas, and they came to me because I had advertising experience, and I knew how to use media, how to talk through media in a way. This is, we're talking about the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s. I knew how to use media and use advertising that had formerly been only used for commercial purposes, how to be effective enough so that our advertising got more attention with less money than the other side's. So it's just a question of learning how to use the media properly. And Brower was great at it, and I was good at it, too. And so we were very effective that way. So we could run campaigns that were, you know, a fifth of the volume, financial volume, as the other guys. And we were succeeding anyway because the truth has a ring to it, you know. And if people get to see it, they can recognize the truth despite all the bullshit that's on the other side of it. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. And that leads to the question of the situation you've described is a situation faced by more or less every activist every single day. And
that's true.
You've
got to find a way to do your message, but you've also got to find a way to get the money to do it, you know, and to keep doing it. And that means being more effective than the other side. In other words, finding a way to talk through the media so that you can create surprise and reaction, you know, beyond what the commercial media is doing.
And how, what fruit of your experience, what advice can you give to younger activists who are entering onto those same paths today that you were doing in the 60s and 70s? How can you help them with your experience?
Well, I don't know. That's a tough question for me to answer because I was able in those days to articulate the arguments very, very well, and to help people like David Brower and others articulate what they wanted to say. But I was also able to raise the money to get them in the media so they ran someplace, you know, because I'm sure there are lots of people who can articulate their arguments very, very well. The only question is whether they can use the media sufficiently cleverly or willingly to have an exposure in the media that is, if not equal to, at least sufficiently effective so that it overcomes the other side's arguments. Did I make my point clear there? I mean, what I'm saying is that it's a question. It's not only doing the work, it's not only doing the ads and making the arguments, but you got to find a way to project them through commercial media, which is what we live inside right now. And so that's part of the problem, is finding a way to get the funds and get the attitude so you can project them. And that you can only do by doing a good draft, let's say, a good layout, good ads, and then finding the money to run them. And that's just as important as part of the other side has the money to run their stuff. But we have to do the work and find the money, and that's difficult. It's difficult, but if we do it well enough and we work on it hard enough and we are speaking in the same voices as people are trying to speak, we'll get the attention. And we did. You know, we got those. Dave Brower and I and others managed to create responses that were very convincing and that people cared about enough so that they would put up money to do it. And then the ads themselves were effective enough so the ads themselves produced some money and enabled you to do another round of the ads. Am I making myself clear or am I being fuzzy?
No. You're being very clear. Thank you. So just for... I mean, since this is quite a while ago, and some people may not, I mean, it's horrible, but some people may not even remember David Brower at this point. Can you?
Oh, God.
I know. He was one of my heroes when I was all through my teens, 20s, 30s. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
Can you just mention a couple of the campaigns that you and he worked on together?
Well, the Sierra Club campaigns were, there was the attempt to save Grand Canyon was the early campaign that was very, very, very important because Grand Canyon was going to be developed in terrible ways. And so Brower came to us desperate and said, we've got to find a way to save Grand Canyon. How can we do it? And I said, well, we can try to... You know, most people didn't even know that was going on. Most people didn't even know that, there was commercial development planned and already underway to some degree to transform Grand Canyon into basically a commercial venture and to destroy its original powers and intentions. So we had to raise enough money to get it going, and then we had to do ads that were powerful enough so people reacted to them and they loved them and wanted to do support them, and that's what happened. That's what we did, and we were successful. And Brower, of course, was unendingly effort. You know, he had, his efforts were nonstop, and they were beautiful and wonderful, and he would keep going no matter what. And he taught me a lot, and I taught him a lot, and so it was a good partnership, and we won a lot of campaigns. We won the Redwood Park campaign, the Grand Canyon. We stopped the problems of development in Grand Canyon, and we did many other campaigns over the years. We had a good partnership.
I love the fact that you just let people know that the Grand Canyon was in danger. A lot of people might not know that. Can you list another?
It was right on the edge of being destroyed. It was very, very, very seriously in danger. It was, you know, they wanted to have developments in Grand Canyon and block it up and do all kinds of things.
And you listed Redwood Park. Can you list a couple of the other campaigns?
Oh, let's see. I actually can't think of them at the moment. But most of the effort that I did with Brower was about Grand Canyon and Redwood National Park. That's most of the stuff I did with Brower.
Well, you know, I don't know if you know this, but I live in Crescent City, right next to Redwood National Park.
Wow.
And can you tell us a little bit about your work on that? I mean, I literally live 2 miles from the old growth here.
Huh. Well, we did ads in the New York Times that explained that Redwood Park was going to be, they were cutting down the redwoods, and pretty soon Redwood Park wouldn't be the same thing, and it was turning into a commercial development. And if you care about the Redwood Park, you got to do something about it. I mean, that's, I don't know what else to say in answer to that question. We just try to generate ferocious resistance, and we did. Were you around in those days?
No, I didn't move here until 1999.
Oh, that's where you're calling from right now.
Yeah, and in fact, I moved here specifically because of the redwoods. So if it weren't for your work, I wouldn't be living here.
Good. Well, I'm looking through a book right now to find a couple of those ads that we did, but I'm not finding them right now. I mean, Redwood Park. I can't find them. We did quite a few ads, and we raised the money for them, and we stopped most of the development of Redwood National Park. Although some of it did go down under this. I'm just trying to find. I should have pulled out those ads for you now. I'm trying to find them. I can't find them. But that was a very successful campaign. And Redwood Park was already being cut down. You know, it was just being used like trees were, you know, it was awful what was happening. And I'm trying to find, I have a booklet of my ads, and I can't find that particular one. I wonder, Alcatraz, the Bay, Upside City, Tombstones. Here's a headline. Here's one of the ads. History will think it most strange that America could afford the moon and $4 billion airplanes while a patch of primeval redwoods, not too big for a man to walk through in a day, was considered beyond its means. That was the headline of one of the big ads that we did. And went to Ronald Reagan, the when Ronald Reagan was flooded with responses and scared him. So they didn't go through with it all the way. They did do some. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. No, that's great. That's great. So
I could send you a copy of that if you want that ad. You've seen it.
Oh, that would be great. Let's talk about that after the interview.
Here's another one. Dinosaur, Big Bend, Glacier, Grand Canyon, Redwoods, Mammoth, even Yellowstone. How can you guarantee these, Mr. Udolph? Grand Canyon is down. Oh, yeah, it was connected. That was the era I was doing the Grand Canyon ads at the same time, and I did the Redwood ads. The Grand Canyon ads came first, and the Redwood ads. But the Redwood campaign was very successful. They did cut some Redwoods, but we did this fantastic chart from 2 billion BC when the first man appeared, the Redwoods. Then 115 years ago when the logging started, and then the amount of Redwoods that had not been cut, and we were asking the amount we were asking to save, and we managed to do it, but it was a horrible experience.
And you just mentioned Dinosaur National Monument. Did you do a campaign about that too?
Dinosaur National Monument?
Yeah.
I don't think I did a campaign on that.
Okay, because you just mentioned it.
When did I mention it?
Oh, I thought you mentioned it when you mentioned the Grand Canyon. Sorry, I must have misheard.
I don't think I did.
Okay.
Let me just look what it says here. No, I don't think so. It was Ronald Reagan was president. All these responses went to him, and also to Davis Weyerhaeuser, chairman of the board of the Redwood Company, and Owen Cheatham, chairman of the board of Georgia Pacific. And Edgar Wayburn was the guy we worked with on that from the Sierra Club. He was the vice president of Sierra Club, and he and I did these campaigns. I mean, he provided me all the material, and I did the ads.
Right.
And they were very successful.
So let's switch.
In the sense that it reduced the amount of cutting that would have taken place otherwise. None of them are 100% successful.
Well, that of course is the classic line by David Prower about how all of our environmental losses are permanent and our environmental victories are temporary.
That's true. We have to stay sharp. We have to stay sharp all the time because it's in the nature of corporate thought and behavior that they're never going to stop because what they're there to do is to use whatever resources they can find. If there's a bunch of redwood trees sitting around, and they're going to want them to cut them down and to cut them up and to, you know, that's their resource. That's what they live by. So they want to get us out of the way, and they want to just go ahead and do it. That's obvious, right? You know that.
Oh, absolutely. That's one reason that they're trying to mine oceans now, and they're...
Yeah, I know. But the Redwood Park exists, so we've saved something.
Right.
Grand Canyon exists, so we've saved something. But look at the world. The world is completely fucked up. It's hard to say that we're winning because we're losing. And the world is being destroyed. We've won in certain specific battles. We've managed to hold them off. There's no guarantee that it'll stay that way, you know. But right now, that's the situation. And we're always functioning at a disadvantage because they have unlimited amounts of money and we don't. And so our ads, our arguments and so on, have to be much more effective than theirs because we don't have the money to match the amount of money that they're spending to promote it. So one of our ads has got to be good enough to offset 50 of their arguments. You hear what I'm saying? So we managed to find ways of talking through media and making very powerful impacts. And that's what we tried to do every day. And sometimes we succeeded and sometimes we didn't.
Yeah, you know, we don't have to go in this direction, but what you said about, you know, we've protected the Redwood Park and Grand Canyon, but other areas are being destroyed, is like all of the activists I know, and this has been true ever since I was a baby activist back in the 80s, is that we're basically trying to protect this or that place. And just, well, it's like a friend of mine says, John Osborne, that if bull trout are still around in 30 years, they may be around in 100. But if they're gone in 30, they're gone forever. And we're basically
that's good.
Trying to hold off this destruction long enough for the system itself, the destructive system itself, to collapse, and then for the Earth to recover as best it can.
Yeah, well, God bless us if we can do that. I mean, I think there's no question that the development, you know, the commercial development elements have been overpowering us, even to the degree that even though we've done good jobs on certain specific issues, and we continue to help protect those specific things. Look at the planet. I mean, you know, there's like the desire for the commercial drives of the corporations globally are very, very powerful, and they're almost impossible to stop. We can stop them in specific cases sometimes, and we do. We have in several, you know, in half a dozen different instances, we've held them off, and we've saved someplace for a while. But look what's happening on the planet. Look at the whole thing. The whole thing's a disaster. So we can't really call anything a victory, I don't think, because it's just a holding action. We managed to hold off a lot, but the commercial, corporate, financial control is global, you know, and it's very, very hard to prevent it from popping up wherever it pops up. I don't see yet a general consciousness in the world which will not let this kind of commercially oriented development, and where the planet is really run by commercial interests. I don't see that being stopped. I mean, I see that still happening very strongly, and I don't know how to stop it. If somebody gave me the amount of money that corporations have, and I could run ads all the time, maybe I could do better. But we've had some successes, and that's what you and I are talking about. And so we try to take those models and amplify them and use them in other places. But this planet is in trouble.
Yeah. What is the relationship between this culture devouring the world and the arguments that you make in your extraordinary book, In the Absence of the Sacred?
Well, what is that question? Can you repeat that question?
Sure.
What's the relationship between it?
What's the relationship between this culture devouring the planet and the arguments that you make in your extraordinary book, In the Absence of the Sacred?
Well, I don't know what specific arguments we're talking about, but I think there's no question that the world is dominated by commercial interests. It's definitely true in capitalist countries, but it's also true in Russia, and it's also true in other countries where a small number of people who have a financial interest in having things move in a certain direction and also have the ability to control the political process through financial powers, it's going to be very hard to stop them in a permanent way. And I think the only thing that will stop it is actually the breakdown of the planet. In other words, the inability to keep doing it because society can't go on like that. It just fails after a while. But we're not there yet. And I don't know if we'll ever get there, or what kind of horrors we're gonna have to go through to get there. Because right now, I mean, you'd have to agree with me that the commercial drives are dominant, and we've had victories, and that's what you and I are talking about. And we will continue to have victories if we can get access to the media and do stuff. But the financial interests are overwhelming every place, and it's very difficult to offset that. Now, things could break down on the planet in a really serious way, and people start dying off, and you know, tragedies like that start happening. That could slow it all down, but the slowdown would only happen after terrible catastrophe, and so I'm not in favor of it. I don't know the answer to the question you're asking, I don't think.
Well, another way to ask this question is instead of attempting to get you to correlate those two, can you summarize quickly the arguments that you did make in the absence of the sacred?
Well, the arguments were that we're destroying nature and that human populations will result in terrible consequences because of that, and that the world is being run by a relatively small number of powerful interests that are in control of governments and economic activity all over the world. I'm not sure I understand your question. Am I answering it?
Yes, you are. And then there's one other thing I wanted to get at, which is that there have been cultures who have lived without necessarily destroying their land base.
Absolutely, I have. The indigenous cultures in many locales, including the United States, have lived within the boundaries of nature's needs, and they've lived that way for hundreds, thousands of years in some cases. So there's no question that we don't have to go toward this commercial suicide that we're going toward at the moment, and that it's possible to have cultures which are making fair deals with nature and living in a comfortable manner, or living by different values and successfully, and have been doing so for hundreds of years or longer. And those are the models, of course, that we need to follow. And we sometimes do. We try to sometimes. And there are people, there are cultures, and there are activities which are consistent with balancing your activity so that nature survives and nature is thrives, and that humans thrive together with nature. That can be done and has been done in many parts of the world, but usually on a smaller scale, and usually without media blasting about it, you know, because they're just taking care of their own area and their own business. And it's true in some parts of the United States as well. Some of the indigenous work and population of the United States have been very, very successful, but it's small scale compared to the larger machine that's operating. And there are other parts of the world also where it's successful. But as long as this economic machine, driven by capitalism in particular, is operating, it's going to be a constant struggle to try to stop it, because every time a capitalist shows up in the morning, their job is to destroy some of nature and turn it into money for themselves. So it's like it's a tough battle. We've got to battle it, and that's what you and I do. We try, and we win sometimes, and we do make successes, and we try to find a way of convincing other people to take on similar stances and work toward it. And we've had some victories, as you and I have just discussed. You know, it hasn't been all failure. But overall, when you look at the planet overall right now, I'm not so sure we have a victory at all. I think the whole thing is going to collapse soon, pretty soon.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah.
And you know, you just mentioned some people living without destroying their place. And where I live and where you helped save with the Redwoods, the Talawa have been carbon dated to have lived here at least for 12,500 years.
Yeah, I'm sure there are other communities like that. Many of them, in fact. It's just that they're so small compared to the larger dynamics and the larger power struggles that people don't even know about them. But I know that there are lots of survival, very successful, indigenous, small-scale survival systems where people continue to live. But will they continue to live if things go really as bad as they may go? You and I are not in control. And it's like we do the best we can, and we've had some victories, but the overall drives of these economic systems, particularly capitalism, but it can also be true of even non-capitalist societies, where individual power and commercial power and so on is still operating, and where there's no general thought about where it's all going and where it's only a day-to-day thing, and let's get the money today and do something with it. I mean, the dynamics of the world are very negative, no question about it. But there are some people who are doing well, and you've just described. I've met many indigenous populations in particular that have been successful and are still successful. They're the inspiration for all of us.
This is a terribly unfair question, but you know, I'm a veteran activist now. I've been an activist for 30 some years, and you are one of my heroes and elders. And you know, I've been working on these issues for decades, and it still boggles my mind that people can be crazy enough to believe you can have an economy that is based on destroying the land base and somehow expect to have any sort of future. And I don't understand. How can anybody be crazy enough to how can anybody be crazy enough to have an economic system that is destroying the basis of life?
It's up to you to answer that question. You've given the answer. It's crazy. There's no other way to put it. It's like self-destructive in the extreme, bound to fail. There's no it's short run. In other words, the people, you know, I think the people who are driving that kind of thing that you're talking about they just want to have a good time this week or today or this year, or they want to live in a fancier manner than their neighbors do, or they want to move around the world without anybody restricting them. They want to be able to do what they want. And there's no sense of that it's attached to any larger system, or that the whole thing could collapse, or that they even care about that. It's just short run gain and pleasure. I don't know how to answer your question.
So we're running out of time. We have two in more ways than one. And I just have a couple quick questions left. One of them is, so how has, you know, you were working with Brower a long time ago. What changes, for better or worse, have you seen in the environmental movement itself over the past 40 years? And the other question would be, what advice do you have for the baby activists who are 25 and 30?
Oh, you're asking the toughest questions in the world. What was the first part about?
The first part is, how would you say, for better or worse, that the environmental movement itself has changed over the past 40 years? What have you seen that you either like or dislike?
I think the environmental movement is expressing a greater awareness of the totality and all of the connections that we're living in, that we are alive. We're sort of a bug in the midst of a giant creature, and we're trying to sustain our lives and sustain the lives of a larger system, while the larger creature, at least most of it, many parts of it, are only interested in certain self-interested powers that are crazy, you know, that are stupid, but that drive the larger system and they are in control of it. They're still in control of it now. We have occasional victories, as we mentioned earlier. And there are some communities, small-scale communities, indigenous communities, that manage to stay separate from it and live in traditional, environmentally sound manner. And they are our models. We have to help, them survive, and we have to try to copy it. But the larger-scale capitalist system in particular is just not interested in any of this resistance. You know, they'll just overpower it if they can, and for the moment they are. And that's what's true. That's just what's real right now. Now, it's true that the planetary breakdown, the breakdown of nature, and the breakdown of the ability of human beings to have survival capacity or pleasures or I don't know what, for it to be worth it, that could collapse. And in some areas, it does collapse. We've been talking about, you know, indigenous communities are very often very aware of all this and very and choose pathways that are very fundamentally sound. But if you're asking me how, you know, what to do about the larger thing, you know, all I can say is you can show up every day and do what you can. That's about all I can say. I mean, we try to make movements. We do make movements. We gather with each other. You and I are talking on a phone, you know, about trying to figure out a way to do it. And sometimes we're successful. I have been successful in numerous specific campaigns, such as the, you know, we mentioned the Grand Canyon and the Redwoods and so on, but many others, dozens of them. But usually they're small scale and they don't have any larger effect on the whole system. And the larger system is driven by financial powers that are capable of overcoming small scale local resistance. So it's not good.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. And so final question is, so what advice would you have for baby activists, young activists, 25, 30, who are just getting into the struggle?
My only advice that I can give people like that is go for it. Do what you can. Try the best you can. Try to organize. It's pleasurable, you know. It's like you and I, when we do our resistance, we have a good time. It's good. It's fun. I mean, it's joyful because you know you're doing the right thing, and you know you meet other people who are similarly inclined, and you get together and you act as a team, and you have some victories. I've had quite a few victories, but not on the scale that'll save the world. And so it's like all you can do is keep going and hope that somehow something will break through. And I can't tell you exactly what that would be. I don't know. If I knew, I would go out there and try for it right now. Instead, I'm talking on the phone with you. It's like, you understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, I think you did answer the question, and I think that your life is also answering the question. And
you do what you can, you know. To summarize, you do what you can. You realize what's going on in the world. You see the destruction. You see how horrible it is. So you wake up every day and you try to do something about it. And sometimes you can do something about it. Sometimes you do stop some horrible thing from happening. Sometimes it's on a very local basis, and other times it's more broader. And you can. So that's all you can do. What can you do other than that? You're not God. We're not God. You know. So God is all fucked up, apparently.
Well,
I don't really mean to say that.
Well, thank you so much for your decades of work, and thank you for being one of my all-time heroes.
Thank you.
And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Jerry Mander. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.